In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
CRIMEWAV. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit. And now it's time for Mark Coggins' second part of Ride a Red Dragon.
The photograph I bribed the morgue attendant to take of the dead gunman wasn't bad enough. The lighting in the autopsy room wasn't muddy enough. The dull, half-open eyes of the gunman didn't look empty enough. And the abraded skin on his cheek and forehead didn't show through the pancake makeup clearly enough. So to make matters worse, I dropped the photo face down on the grimy floor of the Red Dragon Tea House and Fantan Parlor. I reached down to pick up the photograph, and a red spike-heeled pump made its presence known by mashing down my outstretched fingers none too gently against the 5x7 glossy. Attached to the pump was a long and slender leg sheathed in a dark silk stocking. More pressure was applied to my fingers and the leg flexed forward until the handsome knee that went with it butted square against my forehead. I heard a rustling of silk then, and a red curtain came down over my head. I was pinned to the floor of a Chinatown gambling house with my head up a woman's dress. "You like what you see?" said a lilting voice above me. "The view is swell," I groaned. "It's the boot heel manicure I could do without." Abruptly, my hand was released, and I snatched the photograph from the floor and struggled to my feet with as much dignity as I could muster. "Juan Rung, not wearing boots, silly fellow," intoned the woman in front of me. She was tall and busty, especially for a Chinese, with jet-black hair cut in a short bob that began to curl when it reached her chin. Her face was done up like a porcelain doll's. A pale white foundation with a beauty mark painted high on her left cheek, shockingly red lipstick, and a lot of dark goo applied around the eyes, all topped off by a long set of false eyelashes that she batted slowly the way a resting butterfly pulses its wings. The dress she wore was a tight, slinky number with a high collar and the image of a dragon done in gold sequins down the front. The revealing slits up the sides seemed longer than the Great Wall. "Boots or no, beautiful countenance, your tread is not soft like the caress of a rose petal." Mentioning the English translation of her name earned me a big smile. "Juan Rung can be very soft," she said, and reached around to stroke the back of my neck. "You buy me a drink and maybe you see." Her touch sent a shiver down my spine. I took hold of her arm and pushed it back. "Soft is nice, Juan Rung, but tonight I want cold, hard facts. I came to see the boss man." "Go tell the son of an emperor who runs this place that Vic Lane is here and he wants to talk turkey." Juan Rung laughed derisively. "You know make friends very well, Mr. Vic Lane. Sit there. Maybe Pu Ren come, maybe not, but whichever, he know like rude man." I eased into the rickety booth along the wall and watched as Juan Rung walked the length of the smoky room to a curtained doorway. As she pulled the curtain aside, I caught the glimpse of a dimly lit office with a massive oak desk and a small, neat Chinese sitting primly behind. The curtain swung back, and I was left to file my nails and ponder the frenzy game of Fantan being played at the table beside me. I was down to cuticles, and one Fantan player was two C-notes lighter before I decided Juan Rung's man, Pu Ren, was a little too bashful for my taste. I got up from the table and walked to the doorway. No sound came from the office, and there wasn't enough space between the curtain and the doorway to see inside. I grabbed hold of the fabric and pushed it back. Then I knew I'd been had. There was a low grunting noise and a meaty paw clamped onto my wrist like a pipe fender's wrench. My arm yanked back through the doorway, and I had to go with it. Inside, I came face to face with my dance partner, a hulking Chinese with a broad, flat face, immense shoulders, and a powerful chest. He was dressed in black, and his breath smelled from 3 feet away. I made a fist with my free hand and swung for his head. He blocked that easily and stepped forward to grab my throat with both paws and slam me into the corner of the office. My head whipped back against the plaster and the pressure on my throat made my vision go spotty. I reached up to pry the Chinese fingers loose, but bending steel girders would have been easier. Frantically, I kicked at his shins. I groped forward to mash his face. I pounded his forearms. Nothing made a difference. The spots in front of me bled into an opaque curtain and I heard my breath gurgling like water in a cooling radiator. I was all but unconscious when a calm voice at my side said something low in Chinese. The grip on my throat lessened and I felt a hand rifling my pockets. "So, Mr. Lane," said the same voice in a cultured British accent, "you wish to talk turkey. How well can you gobble now?" I couldn't even grunt. "There appears to be very little of interest here. Your wallet, complete with private investigator's license, a .38 caliber revolver, a frightfully bad photograph, and... oh, yes, I see. You have a matchbox from our establishment. Don't tell me. This is a single clue to the strange and baffling disappearance of Mr. Hoosett's pet hamster. The papers have been full of the case. No doubt the photograph is of the hamster." "No, of course not. I do the hamster injustice. It must be of the redoubtable Mr. Hoosett's himself." A cool hand slapped my cheek. "Wake-up call, Mr. Lane. You may pass out on the floor at some other time, but now be so good as to tell me exactly what you're doing here." I shook my head clear and pried open my eyes. Planted in front of me was the mammoth Chinese with his hands still clapped around my throat. Off to one side, holding the take from my pocket, stood my inquisitor, the tall and busty Wan Rung. "You," I managed to croak. Wan Rung snorted. "Yes, it's me. You thought to speak with the frightened rabbit behind the desk? His name does happen to be Pu Jin, but he is paid for his skill with the abacus, not for dealing with riffraff like you. Now, I shan't ask this question again. What is your business here?" The big Chinese let me pry loose his hands, and I turned to face Wan Rung. "The photograph is of a man who was involved in the raid on Scooter Hawking's gambling house in Half Moon Bay. He and another Lugan crashed the joint on Saturday night and let go with a few hundred rounds from Thompson submachine guns. Scooter Hawkins was killed, but the man in the photograph got his own dose of lead poisoning when the pair made their getaway. I found the Red Dragon matchbox on his body, so I came here to see if anyone knew him." "What a delicate turn of phrase, Mr. Lane. You came here to see if anyone knew him. Did you think that a white man would frequent a fantan parlor deep in the heart of Chinatown?" "I seriously doubt it. A more plausible explanation is that you believe we hired the gunman to terrorize Mr. Hawkins. Isn't that so?" "Golly, did you get all that from your fortune cookie at dinner?" Wan Rung leveled a chilling stare at me. The contrast between her present demeanor and the campy act earlier could not have been more pronounced. "You are a fool," she said finally. "As it happens, I did hear of the raid on the Half Moon Bay gambling house. There is little in the San Francisco area that escapes me. However, the idea that I would sponsor such an assault on Mr. Hawkins' club is preposterous. What possible gain could I achieve by haranguing the owner of a club for rich whites located 50 miles outside of Chinatown? Scooter's club is right near the ocean. Maybe you hope to use it as a landing point for sneaking in coolies from China." Wan Rung spat something in Chinese to the giant beside me. "You are incredible," she shouted in English. "I've wasted enough time. I will let Li Winda demonstrate the error in your thinking." The Chinese giant had already grabbed my wrist and twisted it behind my back by the time Wan Rung's English reached my ears. In the next movement, he shoved my head down to waist level and drove me straight into the wall. The impact knocked me senseless. I remember biting into my tongue as my jaw snapped closed and then slumping to the floor. I might possibly manage to whimper as Li Winda delivered the first kick to my ribs. "You look poorer than the night you ran the Duesenberg into the tree, Mr. Lane," said Jack Hartford as he held open the door of the Half Moon Bay gambling house. "You were steering the Duesenberg, Jack," I said as I hobbled across the doorway. "But I managed to run into something much worse on my own, a Chinese dragon." Jack shook his head like I'd been let out of the hospital too soon. That put him in good company because the doctor who cared for me the last 2 weeks at San Francisco County General agreed. The doctor's opinion was that a concussion, two broken ribs, a punctured lung, and a lacerated tongue were good for at least a month. The savage throbbing I felt in my ribs as I negotiated the stairs of the gambling house convinced me there was merit in his argument, but I wasn't about to stay out of circulation any longer. I had called Angela Hawkins from my hospital bed that morning to set up a meeting for 4 o'clock this afternoon. "Do you want me to help you down the steps, Mr. Lane?" Jack called from behind me. "No, but walk with me to the office and tell me what's been going on around here." Jack caught up with me on the third stair. "There ain't been much going on at all since the shooting. We had the funeral last week Tuesday, but tonight's the first night Mrs. Hawkins decided to let the place open." "Have there been any more threats or beatings?" "None that I know of. Of course, Mrs. Hawkins and Mr. O'Toole don't make a habit of consulting me on every little thing." "O'Toole? Who's this O'Toole character?" "He's the new bouncer Scooter hired before he died. You're fixing to meet him right now." Jack gestured at the closed door to Scooter's office. "They're both waiting for you in there. I best be getting back to my place now, Mr. Lane." I thanked Jack and knocked lightly on the door. "Come ahead," said a male voice. I opened the door and stepped inside. It was difficult to say which had changed more since the night of the shooting, the woman behind the desk or the office itself. Gone was the simple, cheap furniture Scooter had made do with. Gone were the stark walls and the splintered bullet holes and the plaster and paint chips that had rained down from them. In their place were dark mahogany furniture, tasteful wallpaper, and the general air of a lot of money being made. The office was a better fit for the Standard Oil Building in San Francisco than a converted barn in Half Moon Bay. Angela Hawkins had undergone a similar transformation. Her flowing black hair was bobbed short, her silver evening gown replaced by a severe brown suit, and with the exception of an austere film of pale lipstick, her face scrubbed clean of makeup. She had not lost her beauty, that was more than hairstyle and clothes, but she was no longer a warm, glowing emerald. She was a cold, precise diamond. The man standing behind her was a brawny Irishman with red hair, pale skin, and plenty of freckles. His nose was thin, his eyes green, and he had a small, pouty mouth. He wore a loud red tie knotted loosely around an unbuttoned collar and a pair of matching red suspenders. His shirt sleeves were rolled halfway up meaty biceps and tight rings of fabric. "Have a chair," he said abruptly. I ignored him and gazed down at Angela Hawkins. "I want to tell you how sorry I am about your husband, Mrs. Hawkins. It's my fault the chopper squad got to Scooter that night, but I promise you I will not rest until I find and deal with all of the men involved." Angela Hawkins smiled a thin smile. "Please sit down, Mr. Lane. You mustn't think that you were the least bit responsible for my Andrew's death. He was playing a very foolish and dangerous game. Now that I understand the circumstances surrounding the shooting, it seems to be almost preordained." I eased into the chair in front of the desk. "Nothing is preordained, Mrs. Hawkins, unless you believe in palm readers or tarot cards. Anyway, you can hardly expect Scooter to roll over and play dead with someone trying to steal the club from him." Angela Hawkins gave me a blank stare and turned to address O'Toole. "Make Mr. Lane and I a drink, will you, Chuck?" Then to me, "Is scotch all right for you, Mr. Lane? It's quite good. A single malt, in fact." I said scotch would be spiffy. She waited for O'Toole to set the drinks in front of us before continuing. "I'm sorry to have to tell you this, especially in light of what happened in Chinatown, but no one was trying to steal a gambling house from Andrew. It was all something he made up." "Made up? Burned liquor trucks and broken jaws don't result from something you make up. Neither do 1,200 rounds from Thompson submachine guns. Those things were frighteningly real, I'm afraid. The reason Andrew gave for them were not. Andrew was the one attempting to encroach on someone else's business, Mr. Lane. He was trying to take over the bootlegging operation of the man who supplies our liquor. All the threats and acts of violence were reprisals for things that Andrew himself had done." I took a large swallow of scotch and felt it burn at the stitches in my tongue. "That doesn't wash. Why would Scooter feed me a cock and bull story about an extortion attempt when he was trying to put the squeeze on a bootlegger? For that matter, why did he hire me in the first place?" O'Toole cut in. "We needed to find out who was pulling the strong-arm stuff for Campy, the bird with the whiskey. Scooter didn't figure you'd take the job if you knew the real reason, so he passed on the story that he'd been telling Angela and all the other civilians on the staff. You're saying you were in on it, too?" O'Toole hooked a thumb under his suspender. "That's right," he said levelly. "Scooter put me on the payroll to help with the play." I narrowed my eyes and stared up at O'Toole. He met my gaze with an equally steely look. "You're making a big mistake if you accept this man's version of events on his say-so alone," I said to Angela Hawkins. "I don't believe Scooter would make a play like that, and we don't know O'Toole from Adam. My guess is he's working for the people who murdered Scooter." O'Toole snorted. "That's right, Lane," he said. "I'm in cahoots with a horde of evil Chinamen you smoke from their lair at the Red Dragon. If all your gumshoe work is that good, Angela can be sure you've got it right this time." Suppressing a smile, Angela Hawkins stirred her drink with an index finger, then brought the finger to her mouth to lick off the scotch. "I don't mean to belittle your advice, Mr. Lane, but I don't have any doubts that what Chuck is saying is true. You see, I've spoken with this Campy fellow, and we've come to an agreement. If we leave him alone, he'll leave us alone." I started to respond, but she cut me off. "I know what you're going to say. You're going to say that I can't let Andrew's death go unpunished, that I must get my revenge. Well, that's a man's way of thinking, not a woman's. I agree for Andrew, but for me, this miserable affair is over, and I want it to stay that way." "Meaning you don't want me to continue the investigation?" "Meaning exactly that." She pulled an envelope from the top drawer of the desk and set it in front of me. "That is a check for $200. Please take the money for your trouble and let Andrew rest in peace. We'll all be better off that way, believe me." I stared down at the envelope for a long moment and then picked it up and slid it into my coat pocket. "To Scooter's memory, then," I said, raising my glass in a toast. Angela Hawkins clicked her glass with mine and drank the amber liquid it contained. I watched her carefully and then set my glass down without drinking. I stood up and hobbled over to the office door. "Be seeing you," I said, and stepped outside. I felt a cold fury wash over me as I climbed the stairway to the entrance of the club. At the top, I pushed through the double doors and grabbed Jack Hartford by the elbow before he had a chance to turn around. "Come on," I said. "You're going with me." Hartford half-turned and pulled back his arm. "Wait, Mr. Lane. I can't go anywhere now. I'm on duty." "Shut up, Jack. You don't understand. Angela Hawkins is sitting in that office drinking single malt scotch from a cut glass tumbler." Hartford blinked at me. "You're talking crazy, Mr. Lane. What does that mean?" "I'll tell you what it means. It means Angela Hawkins drinks scotch and likes it. It means she didn't send Scooter out of the office to get a gin and tonic the night of the shooting. She sent him out to get killed. So quit flapping your gums and come along. Where are we going? We're going to get revenge. Two platefuls of it. Less than 1 hour later, I was standing in the dank Chinatown alley behind the Red Dragon. Balanced on one shoulder was a 38-inch baseball bat. On the ground beside me was a large wine bottle with a piece of cloth torn from my shirt tail shoved down the neck. The bottle was filled with gasoline, not fermented grape juice. Jack Hartford sat in the driver's seat of my Lincoln at the mouth of the alley. The Lincoln was idling, and Jack had poked his head out the side window to look back at me with a worried expression. I glanced down at my watch and determined it had been more than 60 seconds since the Chinese boy I paid to yell fire had gone into the building. That was all the warning I was going to give them. I nodded at Jack and stepped up to a large pebble glass window that looked down into the basement. With methodical swings, I pounded the glass out of all four window panes and threw the baseball bat down to the floor below. I pulled a kitchen match from my hat brim and set fire to the cloth wick of the bottle. It caught instantly and burned with a fat, greasy flame. Standing back from the window, I lobbed the bottle in underhanded. There was a loud whoosh, and light and flame filled the basement the way a flash flood fills a gully. The fire spread quickly to the wooden crates and burlap sacks stored in the room, and soon billows of black smoke were rolling out of the building. I trotted back to the Lincoln and levered myself into the passenger seat. After pulling the door closed, I slumped against the window and closed my eyes. The exertion had made me lightheaded, and my ribs were smarting like they'd been jabbed with foot-long ice picks. "Are you okay, Mr. Lane?" asked Jack Hartford. "Go, Jack. Just go," I said without looking up. Jack popped the clutch and we screeched out of the alley. As we pulled around the corner, I opened my eyes and saw a crowd of excited Chinese standing in front of the building. Several were gesturing at the open front door, and I could see the first hint of smoke rising out of the entryway. We drove to the Pacific Telephone and Telegraph Company station on Powell Street and double-parked in front. I slid out of the car and went into the building. I dropped my nickel on one of the phones and called Davenport 4040. There were two rings and the line picked up. Somebody said a word in Chinese. "Wan Rung," I growled into the mouthpiece. "I want to talk with Ron Rung." "Ron Wong busy now," said someone. "She no able to talk." "You tell her Vic Lane is calling and it's emergency. She'll want to talk. Just tell her Vic Lane. Got it?" "Vic Lane. Okay." I waited a moment and then Wan Rung's cultured voice came on the line. "How did you attain the number for my residence, Mr. Lane?" "2 weeks in a hospital bed gives a man time for plenty of things." "Just so. What a pity you did not use the time to acquire the wisdom not to interfere in my affairs." "So you've already heard, then?" "I have not heard anything, Mr. Lane. I was merely referring to this most unwelcome telephone conversation. You have more misery you wish to inflict on me?" I laughed maliciously. "We haven't even started. I'm calling for Angela Hawkins, Scooter Hawkins' widow. She says to tell you that the Red Dragon is choking on its own fire this afternoon, and when the Red Dragon is dead, you will be next." There was a sharp intake of breath. "You are a madman. I had nothing to do with the raid on her husband's glove. Goodbye, beautiful countenance. I wonder if they'll call you that when you're lying in a pine box." I set the receiver back on its prong and stared straight at the telephone, not seeing it. Then I went back outside to the car. We got on the coast highway and drove south towards Half Moon Bay. For once, Jack didn't have any questions, and we rode in silence all the way back to Scooter's Club. It was dark by the time we got there, the parking lot already filling with autos. I directed Jack to pull up on the grassy knoll overlooking the gambling house. We sat in the car smoking cigarettes and taking pulls from a whiskey bottle. We sat in the car for over 2 hours, and not a word passed between us. Finally, they came. They came in two panel chucks that skidded into the parking lot, raising clouds of dust that swirled in the light of their headlamps. There were close to 50 men, all dressed in black pajamas, carrying torches and short-handled axes. They tumbled out of the trucks and encircled the building. A group of them charged the front entrance, downing Jack's replacement with a single blow. They set to work on the double doors with their axes, reducing them quickly to splinters. I heard the first shot then, and one Chinaman fell. The rest of the group swarmed into the opening and disappeared down the stairway. The men on the perimeter of the building had not been idle. Here and there, tongues of flames licked at the walls of the wooden barn, and soon the northwest corner of the building was engulfed in fire. I heard more gunfire, then women's screams and the harsh yelling of men, in both Chinese and English. Customers of the gambling house began boiling out of the building. Some ran to their autos and drove off in panic. Others crouched behind their vehicles, staring in dumb amazement. Like clots of oil and water pumped from a bilge, the flow of people from the building darkened as the men in the black pajamas returned from inside. In their midst was a woman, a dark woman with short black hair, a tailored suit, and a slender figure. Her voice rose in incoherent shrieks as the Chinese dragged her along the ground by her hair to one of the waiting trucks. While she thrashed and kicked like an injured animal, a dozen pair of hands lifted her high into the air and passed her into the back. Her last shriek died abruptly as she merged into the darkened interior. The woman was Angela Hawkins. The Chinese at the perimeter of the building ran back to the trucks and piled inside with their cohorts. There was a grinding of gears, and then the trucks made wide, almost leisurely turns out of the parking lot and bounced onto the main highway. I watched as they rounded a broad curve in the road and disappeared from view. The raid had taken no more than 5 minutes, start to finish. "I never thought I'd be so shamed by something I'd done," said a low voice beside me. I turned to look at Jack Hartford and saw the firelight from the building reflected in his eyes. "There was no other way, Jack," I said. "We had to avenge Scooter's death." "Is that why we had to do it? Is that really why? I thought maybe we did it because you got beat up at the Red Dragon, and Angela Hawkins and Chuck O'Toole made a fool of you. I thought that might have been it." "Shut up, Jack," I said hotly. "You don't know what you're talking about." "You might be right, Mr. Lane. Maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. But I do know I ain't staying with you no more. I got to get myself away and get clean of this thing. Best you and me call it quits right here." Jack lumbered out of the car and began walking towards the highway. I jumped out to follow, but stopped dead in my tracks as a loud crash sounded. The roof of Scooter Hawkins' gambling house was collapsing in a shower of sparks. I breathed a deep breath and felt all of my strength and will go out of me. "So long, Scooter," I said aloud. "You deserve better than any of us gave you."
That's the second part of Ride a Red Dragon by Mark Coggins, a San Francisco crime writer with a San Francisco story there set in the 1920s. If you like this story, you should check out more of Mark's work. He has 4 books out in the August Reardon series. The most recent one is Runoff, published this year by Bleak House Books.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
Here's a song to the star, but the shape of a snake and a smile that went along with that.
Get dressed!
No, 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 no.